Blog Talk Radio.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Good evening, everybody tuning in to the broadcast, another episode of The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. I want to thank all the listeners out there for continuing to support this effort to establish justice. Very pleased with today's show. Our guest, author of Racial Matters, the FBI's Secret File on Black America, 1960 to 1972, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great.
Fantastic. Could you share, I guess, any pertinent, any pertinent information about yourself, other books that you've written, just anything you think would be of interest to our listeners this evening?
Sure, I'll give a quick background tour. I came up in New York and Detroit, and I went to graduate school and got interested in American history. And so I got my degree in that and started writing. And I've been writing since, a long time now, since the 1970s. And I did my first book on McCarthyism, you know, red hunting, looking under beds for communists and all that stuff, a book called Hoover and the Un-Americans. And then I moved into the next biggest area where the FBI was involved. See, my first book on McCarthyism focused on the relationship between the congressional red hunting committees and the FBI. And in doing that, I noticed that the FBI was really interested in civil rights issues and especially spying on black activists. And so I thought, well, I'd do another book on the FBI and the civil rights movement, and that's the book we're going to talk about tonight, Racial Matters. And then after that, I did a book on, I did another FBI Black America book called Black Americans, the FBI Files. Mm-hmm. And then I moved into the area of the presidency, and I did a book on the White House and racial politics all the way back to George Washington and forward through Bill Clinton. And, boy, that book can be with Barack Obama running for president. And I was getting calls from reporters, you know, pretty much every day throughout the campaign. And right now I'm trying to finish a book on the Bush-Cheney era. And there are a lot of color line issues in the Bush-Cheney years, too. And so, really, that's my focus. I do political history and my main interest is in racial politics, and so far I've focused mostly on the black-white color line, but I've also got some interest in the red-white color line, American Indians, and some of that comes from my background, too, because I spent 22 years up in Alaska teaching at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and Native American politics, Alaska Native politics up there is really a big thing because the whole state is basically Indian country. Mm. And what a lot of people don't realize also is a lot of the indigenous people in Alaska aren't Indians either. There are all sorts of different groupings of indigenous people up there.
Wow. Very interesting. This radio show also exclusively focuses on issues of racism, white supremacy. That's why I felt it was very important to read your work. and I really want to hop into that. First, I want to ask really quick, are you a white person?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Irish. Although, being Irish, there's a book titled How the Irish Became White,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, 100 years ago, the Irish weren't quite considered white people. And that's more of the history of eugenics and racialism rather than racism. But a lot of different white groups had, you know, real issues in the United States as well. I mean, not like American Indians or African Americans, but they still had issues. And so a lot of Irish, Italians, you know, Russians, Jews, and back in the day, they weren't considered white people.
Yeah, I am aware of that book. I've been working behind the scenes to try to get that author to come on the show. He has a blog that I check out from time to time as well. I wanted to ask for this show, white supremacy, racism, the definition that I use for white supremacy is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or mistreating everyone they classify as not white. Do you believe that is a accurate definition?
I quibble with it a little bit. I think the quibbling I would do, I would use a word like hegemony rather than white, because in today's world, I think a lot of the movers and the shakers from the they don't particularly care what color you are. They care if you've got money and they can take it. And so I would quibble, again, just a little with that, not too much.
Okay. So do you agree that such a system exists? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, the way the, and again, it's, you read the mainstream media, they don't, again, don't define it in those terms. They talk more about globalization and hegemony and, you know, finance capitalism and all that stuff. But my own view of racism is again, a little bit different. And I look at racism as, you know, a utilitarian tool. It exists not because it's in our DNA or it's inevitable. It exists because it's useful to certain people.
Would those be white people?
Well, generally, yeah. That's
okay.
The bottom line there. If you look, I'm in history, so I'll do a lot of, you know, way back analogies.
Yes,
but
sir.
If you look at how slavery came to America in colonial Virginia in the 1600s, slavery came, it basically is an unthinking decision. The planters just started buying slaves. But, you know, like you would go to the grocery store and, you know, what am I going to buy? Am I going to buy Rice Krispies or Corn Flakes? And they just pick one, buy it. And that's how slavery came to Virginia. But if you look at how racism came to Virginia, that was debated in the Virginia House of Burgesses, which was really the first legislature in America, along with the General Court in Massachusetts. But they actually debated racism, and they created slave codes and all sorts of other things. And I always thought that's really, really interesting, that slavery comes as basically an unthinking decision, but racism, they debated it quite a bit. You know, it's a chicken and egg question, you know, or horse, you know, which, you know, horse before the cart, I guess. And another thing that's interesting, going way back, and again, that's my thing, history, I go way back, is if you look when the English came, they were right off the boat, they were incredibly racist toward Indians. And that's because the English knew they wanted Indian land. And, of course, you can ask someone to leave their home, but they're probably not going to do that. So if you want their land, you're probably going to have to kill them. You know, the Indian Wars, America's longest war, 400-year war. And so the English, extremely racist from day one. But when the French came over here, the French did not have nearly that degree of racism. The French cooperated with the Indians. I mean, there was even an edict from the French king to marry, you know, French fur traders, men to marry Indian women. And that's because the French wanted, you know, beaver pelts, the fur trade. And so there's very little racism. And so in my mind, what drives racism is a utilitarian purpose. And see, the English, they're extremely racist because they want Indian land. They want to cut down the trees. They want to, you know, put up farms. And to do that, they're going to have to kill Indians. And human beings, we're not hardwired to kill each other. And it's a lot easier if you can dehumanize the enemy. And so racism is useful for that. But with the French don't want to cut down the trees. You cut down the trees, you have no fur trade. And so they cooperate with the Indians, and there's comparatively very little racism. So what drives racism, if you look at the experience of the English and the Indians and the French and the Indians, it's, you know, what do they want? And so racism is utilitarian. It's like reaching into your toolbox, and you need a particular tool, and if you need that tool, you pull it out. And the British needed racism, so they used it. For the French, racism would get in the way, so they left that tool in the box.
I want to hop in. I appreciate that, particularly the respect for history. I also a student of history and have a great appreciation for digging in the archives, so to speak, and getting a better understanding of why things are the way they are today by looking back. And I really want to hop to your book here, because I think this is really important information. And it's been my experience that most of the non-white people that I come in contact with are just not informed about the material in your book. I wanted to read you, this is a quote from Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her or not. She is a non-white female clinical psychologist, child psychologist, third-generation physician. On the very first page of her book titled The ISIS Papers.
I know that book, sure.
Oh, okay. On the first page of the book, she says, "No persons who classify themselves as white living in the area of the world referred to as the United States of America, or for that matter, in any other area of the world, should presume to tell any black person or other non-white person what racism is or is not until they have read completely Kenneth O'Reilly's Racial Matters. No black person living in the area of the world referred to as the United States of America should discourse on racism or deny the conspiratorial dimensions of the local and global system of racism until he or she has read Racial Matters completely. All non-white people should read and discuss the implications of the book Racial Matters, the implications for themselves and as individuals, and the implications for their collective should be discussed in depth." How do you feel about someone having that to say on page one of their book about your work, Racial Matters?
Yeah, well, that makes me feel good, and I've got, you know, for Racial Matters, I got several reactions like that. Ranging from Al Sharpton, who said it was his favorite book. Oh, actually, he said one of my other books was his favorite, Nixon's Piano. Mm-hmm. And then when when Enos Cosby was murdered?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Camille Cosby, said, you know, people should read this book, and that, you know, in her response to her son's murder.
Wow.
One of her recommendations is all Americans should read this book. So yeah, occasionally you get those responses. But you want to know an irony here. Almost all white reviewers of Racial Matters thought it was a good book. And I thought that was ironic, because pretty much all the white reviewers misread it. And that,
what do you mean?
Well, that's a very unusual book. I write about contentious topics, and my work doesn't make everybody happy. Some people love it, and some people hate it. So there's usually no happy middle ground. People love or hate my work. But with Racial Matters, it was different. Everybody loved it. And most of the white reviewers, what I noticed is they misinterpreted the book. And by that I mean they interpreted the book as if I was saying it was all J. Edgar Hoover's fault. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, was a longtime FBI director. From 1924, even before that, really, he was one of the ramrods in the bureau, going back to 1919. But from 1924 to 1972, he ran the FBI, And he was, in fact, you know, a pretty racist guy, and he was in some ways pretty horrible. He had some good traits. I hate to say that, but he did. But in terms of black people, very few good traits. He was pretty much a monster. But my book didn't place the blame on him per se. My book argued that J. Edgar Hoover did what he wanted to because he was allowed to do it. People higher up, the Kennedys, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and so forth, they allowed Hoover to do what he wanted to do in black America. But the reviewers all argued that, you know, it was all Hoover's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got unanimously great reviews, but I was still upset because, you know, most of the white reviewers just completely misinterpreted what I was saying.
I am really pleased to hear that because, as I said, I read your book some years ago and went back and reread it when I emailed you and talked about getting you to come on the show so that I could be fresh in having a conversation about this book. And the thing that jumped out at me, the two words that I kept writing down, system, just – this is not just, and I mean, we're going to get more into detail about this, but this was not just a one-person thing. This wasn't even just an FBI thing. This is, this would be a book I would point to anyone who says that there is not a system of racism, white supremacy in place. I would give them your book and tell them to read it very slowly because I think you do an excellent job of illustrating how this became a total team effort to crush black people who were attempting to counter racism, white supremacy. But I want to go back to...
It's basically permanent war. I mean, it's sort of loosened up now with Obama and so forth, but that's what I argue in the book, that this is not J. Edgar Hoover's fault. He is who he is, but he did what he did because he was allowed to do it, and he was allowed to do it because the government essentially is... It's a permanent war on the color line in this country. And,
for sure.
That's what I tried to argue.
I got you loud and clear. I felt it was pretty easy if you read the book. And just backing on what you just said, on page 8 of your book, you said the history of a government that has been at odds more often than not over the past 200 years with its own non-white citizens. Before the FBI was even established, Marcus Garvey and the United Negro Improvement Association, the Bureau of Investigation and Mr. J. Edgar Hoover, they were working in opposition to Mr. Marcus Garvey. This is, you know, over 80 years ago before
It goes even back further than that. I mean, one of the, arguably the FBI's first big case was against Jack Johnson. And, of course, he was the first black heavyweight boxing champion of the world.
Yes, sir.
And a Mann Act case, a white slave traffic act case against Jack Johnson.
Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, the FBI was created in 1908, and it was known back then as the Bureau of Investigation. The word federal doesn't get hooked on until 1935.
Mm-hmm.
But be that as it may, just call it the FBI. And so it's founded in 1908. And back then, there's really not much, there are not many federal criminal laws for the FBI to investigate. There's only a handful. But two of the earliest federal laws are, number one, as I just mentioned, the Mann Act, M-A-N-N. That's the White Slave Traffic Act, which made it a federal crime to transport a woman across a state line for immoral purposes. And, of course, Jack Johnson, you know, the boxing champ, a black man, his fiancée is a white woman. So the government's going to use the Mann Act to go get him. And then a second early law that Congress passed made it a crime to transport a stolen prize fight film across the state line. Yeah. And, you know, and one of my theories is even today when you pop in a DVD to watch a movie and the first thing that comes up is, you know, don't violate copyright laws or the FBI is going to come get you. One of my theories, and I'm probably going to do a paper on this someday if I can pin it down, is one little bitty reason you see that warning up there whenever you watch a movie is because of Jack Johnson and the FBI way back in 1910. But in any event, that's how the FBI got its start. But the FBI in Black America is always a little bit mixed, because way back then, the FBI is also investigating federal law violations on the issue of peonage. It's P-E-O-N-A-G-E. And now peonage is, you know, it's almost a form of slavery. And an easy way to explain it is a black man in the South gets arrested for vagrancy, and the judge fines him $10, and he doesn't have any money. And so the judge binds his labor out to, you know, a cotton farmer or a turpentine camp operator in Florida or whatever. And that, you know, camp owner charges this man, you know, room and board and all this stuff. And so each day he works, he owes the court more money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's supposed to work off his $10 fine. But each day he works, the fine gets bigger. And so he's basically held in peonage. And when the FBI was started by Teddy Roosevelt, President Theodore Roosevelt, that was one of Roosevelt's real concerns about peonage, because that was a problem after slavery ended in the South. A lot of freedmen were held as peons. And so Roosevelt wanted to get involved in that, and he sent the FBI. So that's the funny thing about the FBI. When they're running after Jack Johnson and Marcus Garvey, they're also investigating peonage. They're investigating the Ku Klux Klan. And so they're like on both sides. And that remains fairly consistent all the way up to the present. They're on both sides. In other words, the FBI will spy not just on Marcus Garvey or Jack Johnson or Martin Luther King, but they'll spy on Black America as a community, you know, in its entirety. And yet at the same time, the FBI will also investigate, you know, violations of federal civil rights law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all, including King. The FBI investigated the King assassination, even though that type of murder is not a federal crime. But the FBI got into it because the murderer, you know, James Earl Ray, deprived King of his civil rights by killing him. And so that's the way the FBI got into the King investigation, you know, the assassination. We'll talk more about King, I'm sure, later.
For sure. I want to get back to Marcus Garvey because, as I said, most of the non-white people, victims of racism, white supremacy, that I come in contact with are not informed about what the FBI did in the so-called civil rights movement, and they are completely clueless about their involvement with Mr. Marcus Garvey. In your book, you said that Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, hired four black men to work the case, and he assigned one of those men, James W. Jones, to infiltrate the UNIA and to shadow Garvey in Harlem. Hoover attacked Garvey because of the black leaders all around pro-Negroism and Garvey's doctrine of the Negro for the Negro. William Burns of the FBI said Garvey was the most prominent Negro agitator in the world today, and we, the FBI, have been on him. Can you talk about their campaign against Mr. Marcus Garvey?
Yeah, sure. But first, people should realize Marcus Garvey was really a big deal. He's extremely important historically. He doesn't really, you know, translate well into the present. You know, because, you know, his uniform and this and that, he looked kind of goofy. And some of his stuff was pretty goofy. I mean, he was negotiating with the Ku Klux Klan and this and that. Yet at the same time, he represented an enormously powerful movement. And the real issue with the U.S. government and Marcus Garvey is they, as I said in the book, the government, the FBI, identified him as a dangerous person first, and then they went looking for a crime. You know, some way to put him in jail, deport him, whatever. And that's really scary when you identify your target first and then you start searching around for a crime.
Would it be accurate to say that he was labeled by white people in the FBI as a dangerous person because of his efforts to counter racism, white supremacy?
Oh, yeah, sure. But, I mean, it's even worse than that. I mean, the FBI essentially, for much of its history, Now, not the entire FBI. A lot of FBI agents are, you know, decent people, and they do good work. They do legitimate criminal work. The part of the FBI I write about is the political part that gets involved in a lot of this nonsense. Now, I believe it's worse than that. It's not simply that they identify Garvey as dangerous. The FBI basically identifies black people as dangerous across the board, period. And their logic there, actually, there's some logic to that. And their logic is black people in America are treated like garbage. And because they're treated like garbage, they, you know, their loyalties are suspect. And therefore, they're ever-present danger of being a fifth column. And as crazy as...
A fifth column?
That's like a subversive force. You know,
okay.
Termites burrowing in and all this stuff. Now, as crazy as that sounds... Another thing I argued in the book during that early period is other people saw this as kind of normal. For example, when we were about to go to war with Germany in World War One,
yes, sir.
Germany comes up with some screwball idea that they can make an alliance with Mexico. You know, a lot of non-white people in Mexico, and Mexico's not happy because of the Mexican War in the 1840s. They lost, you know, giant chunks of territory to the U.S. But Germany thinks it can make a deal with Mexico and black America to join World War One on Germany's side. Now, that is just, you know, bonkers, completely bonkers. But the logic is the same logic the FBI is using. If black America, if the United States treats black Americans like garbage, then their loyalties to the United States will be suspect. And so what you end up with is an agency like the FBI. Yes, they're interested in Marcus Garvey. They're interested later on in Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Huey and Bobby and all that and Jesse Jackson. But they're also interested in all black Americans, you know, every single one.
Wow.
And so they not only have these, you know, these famous programs that target Jack Johnson and Marcus Garvey or the COINTELPROs in the 60s, but they have all these, you know, community surveillance programs. You know, the FBI tries to recruit, for example, in, you know, what they used to call Colored Town. They go in and try to recruit barbers as informants. You know, because barbershops are often, you know, big, you know, social gathering places and a lot of talk and a lot of gossip. So the FBI makes a big push to recruit black barbers as informants. And they're not interested in spying on, you know, Marcus Garvey's barber. They're interested in just barbers in everyday black America. And so, again, the Bureau will, on the surveillance end, the Bureau would target these very prominent black men like Jack Johnson, Marcus Garvey, or at the middle of the 20th century, Malcolm and Martin and Bobby and Huey. But they would also target pretty much everybody.
Wow.
You know, that would be more passive surveillance. It's just information gathering. What the FBI does against more prominent blacks is not always passive. It's sometimes going to be really, really aggressive.
Certainly, and we're definitely going to get to that as well. But just the information that you just said, I wanted to point out two things because this beautifully illustrates one of the main points that I wanted to drive home in speaking with you in terms of information. I have never in my life talked to a non-white person who had anything close to the information that you just gave in 2 minutes. I have never spoke to any non-white person. And I know non-white people who have doctorates, PhDs in history and all other sorts of fields. I've never talked to a non-white person who has that sort of information, which is why I consistently say, on my show, I believe that Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. is completely accurate in saying white people are much more informed about black people. White people are much, much more informed about all of the non-white people, victims of white supremacy. They make it their business to be informed about non-white people. That's number one. I was going to later on get to what your point that you made about the FBI being concerned with all black people, but that was pretty outstanding right there. You said the term COINTELPRO again, most non-white people that I encounter have no idea what that means. Could you explain that so that, like, if a teenager is listening to this show, they could get a really clear understanding of what you mean when you say COINTELPRO?
Yeah, that's actually really simple. It means.
Can I interrupt you? Sure. I apologize. I took a class from Julian Bond. For everybody out there who does not know Mr. Julian Bond, he was in SNCC, big participant in the Civil Rights Movement. I took a class from him, History of the Civil Rights Movement. COINTELPRO never came up in his class on the history of the Civil Rights Movement. And I just would like to add, well, I'll ask you about that later. I apologize for interrupting. Please continue in explaining COINTELPRO, sir.
Yeah, in a nutshell, COINTELPRO is this. If you come within eyesight of the FBI, they're going to mess you up. Okay, now again, let me qualify that the FBI is not all bad. A lot of what the FBI does is fine, honorable work. But on the political side of the FBI, if you do something they don't like, they won't simply write it down, put it in a file. They will act on it and try to mess you up. Now, the FBI is also sort of non-discriminatory here. The FBI ran these formal counterintelligence programs to mess people up, not just against blacks, although the black COINTELPRO is sort of interesting because two of the big targets are the Prince of Nonviolence, right, King, and the Prince of Violence, Malcolm X. So that's a pretty big program if you can go from King to Malcolm. And so that's one COINTELPRO, but the FBI had a bunch of them. They ran a COINTELPRO against college students who protested the Vietnam War. They ran a COINTELPRO against the old left people, the Communist Party and the Social Workers Party. They even ran a counterintelligence program against the Ku Klux Klan. And the thing about these counterintelligence programs is, number one, this is the police doing this stuff. And what they're doing is just patently illegal. You know, I mean, like in King's case, one of the famous COINTELPRO programs is the FBI starts writing, you know, anonymous letters to Martin Luther King's wife, you know, trying to inspire a divorce, you know, trying to inspire King to kill himself, you know, suicide. I mean, it's just, you know, flat out crazy. But again, a lot of white people were targeted too for the same kind of stuff. Like a college kid protesting the Vietnam War, the FBI might go to, institution or foundation or state agency that's giving that kid a loan or a scholarship and try to get a scholarship revoked. And so it's, you know, really across the board. And you can see the legacy of this type of stuff even today. And once in a while, someone will stand on a street corner with a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and they'll ask people to sign it, like a petition. And people won't do it because they don't want to sign anything because it's dangerous. And one thing about the FBI COINTELPRO is, yeah, if you get involved, it can be dangerous, and the FBI might come after you. Now, having said that, you have to realize the FBI is really not that big. They don't have that many agents. And so they can't go after every Tom, Dick, and Harry. But, again, having said that, one COINTELPRO operation was actually meant to make people believe that they could go after everybody. And so, and again, in other words, the FBI doesn't have the resources to target every single person that bugs them. So instead of doing that, what they do is try to make people afraid. And that was one of the basic counterintelligence tactics, to scare the bejesus out of people.
Would it be accurate then to say that they, your book is focused on racial matters, would it be accurate then that they, one of their objectives was to function as a terrorist organization to non-white people?
Well, yeah, in today's terms, yes. That case can be made. I don't know if I'd go that far. But in today's terms, we have this, in America, we have this really broad definition of terrorism. So you could apply today's terms to that, certainly. But let me just give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about with COINTELPRO. The FBI actually had a program to remove Martin Luther King and replace him with their own leader, and the FBI selected Sam Pierce as the leader of Black America. And, of course, Sam Pierce would go on to be the Housing and Urban Development Secretary in the Reagan administration. And Sam Pierce didn't have a distinguished career. He presided over HUD, you know, during a humongous scandal and ended up with multiple independent counsels and people in jail and all this stuff. But, see, that's a typical COINTELPRO. King, you want to remove King and replace him with your own guy. I mean, that's just nuts. And then another example of a COINTELPRO is the most counterintelligence programs against blacks, at least the formal ones, were targeted the Black Panther Party.
Mm.
And in the course of doing that, the FBI actually got involved in what might quaintly be called incitement to violence.
Mm.
Because the Black Panthers, especially out in California, in San Diego and L.A., they had rivalries with another group.
Yes, sir.
You know, the Kwanzaa people.
Ron Karenga.
Marana Karenga. Yeah, he used to be Ron Everett. And those guys are more what you call, you know, cultural nationalists. You know, the Dashikis and the Shaved Heads and Swahili and all that stuff. And the Panthers are more political guys. You know, they call them revolutionary political nationalists. And so they were rivals. And what happened is both the Panthers and Karenga's group, US, U.S., I think for briefly the U.S. stood for United Slaves, but eventually it just stands for US. But the Panthers versus US, both groups essentially recruited from the same pool. And what both groups wanted to do was to get young black men, especially young black men, boys and men, out of, you know, nihilistic street gang drug violence into something productive. And so they're both the Panthers and US are recruiting from the same pool. And, of course, a lot of those young kids coming out of the gangs into the Panthers or US, a lot of them are really volatile. And what the FBI would do is they'd send put up posters around town and send out letters and this and that, you know, insulting one another, you know, each of these groups. The FBI draw up a picture insulting the Panthers, and they'd sign Karenga's name to it and vice versa and this and that. And they just egg on this rivalry. And again, a lot of the recruits are gang kids that the Panthers and US want to get out of, you know, mindless violence. So they're volatile. And sure enough, for UCLA and other places, they start shooting each other. And you have dead people. And the FBI ends up, you know, patting each other, FBI agents patting each other on the back and this and that, and getting cash rewards as a result of this violence and corpses. I mean, just horrible. But to the FBI's credit, they eventually, you know, put two and two together and say, well, we can't do this anymore. You know, it's like we're, you know, inciting people to murder each other. And so they stop, or at least they say they stop.
Mm.
But that was pretty weird. I mean, you actually had body counts in California, and the FBI would actually send out posters and, you know, fraudulent forged letters listing the body counts.
Mm.
Like if there'd be a shootout and there's three dead Panthers and no dead US members, the FBI, you know, do like a scoreboard, you know, US 0, Panthers 3. And then they'd have three, you know, R and P's, rest in peace, and the names of the three Panthers who were shot dead. So
wow.
The FBI just egging this stuff on. That was pretty crazy. But again, the FBI, you know, they eventually had a pretty open debate about, holy crap, we can't be doing this because it looks like, you know, we're inciting people to murder each other.
I know a considerable amount of your book. You have a whole chapter where you talk about where the FBI, the only good Panther is a dead Panther.
Yeah, and Fred Hampton, Chicago,
yes.
And stuff. Yeah.
That is exactly where I wanted to go with Mr. Fred Hampton. I know a lot of non-white people that I come in contact with are not really familiar with Fred Hampton, what he was trying to do. He was a member of the Black Panther Party in Chicago. and what he was trying to do in terms of curbing that gang violence and trying to get alliances with different non-white groups in Chicago and to work to counter racism, white supremacy. And I feel like that the case of Fred Hampton really illustrates just how ugly
Can
you talk about that?
Yeah, and one thing you mentioned, the Panthers did in fact have no problem making alliances with white groups or predominantly white groups. None whatsoever. Now later on when Eldridge Cleaver came in and you had the Huey Newton Eldridge Cleaver, you know, factionalism and fratricide and all that, yeah, that's different. But for most of their time the Panthers had just no problem at all with, you know, forming alliances with white groups. Now in Chicago, Fred Hampton's really a big deal because, I mean, he is extremely charismatic, extremely talented. You know, everybody loves him. I mean, he's just an amazing person, and he's killed, murdered at a very young age. And what happened with Fred Hampton is the Chicago police would not do what was asked of them. And so the state's attorney down in Illinois got a detail of Chicago police, and they carried out a raid on the Monroe Street apartment on the west side of Chicago where Fred Hampton stayed. Now, of course, this is the 60s, and so in the 60s, you know, in your apartment, especially if you're an activist, at any given night, there might be 8 or 10 people sleeping in there. I mean, because it's just a different time. It's the 60s. And so you have this raid on Fred Hampton's apartment with a whole bunch of people in there. And the raid was set up by the state's attorney in Chicago. And they used Chicago police officers. The Chicago police wouldn't do it on their own, so they went through the state's attorney's office. And the logistics for the raid, you know, the floor plan and what to expect, what the police should expect and this and that, all came from the FBI. And the FBI had an informant in the Panthers, a guy named O'Neill, William O'Neill. And he got a cash reward after it was done.
He was a black male.
Yeah. And what happened was, you know, Chicago police came in, you know, in the middle of the night, everybody's asleep, and this being the 60s and this being the Panthers, one of the Panthers, a guy named Mark Clark, apparently he was sleeping in a chair facing the door with a shotgun in his lap. Because, again, these were brutal times, and the Panthers were not into turning the other cheek. And so the police came in, and Mark Clark got off one shot, but the shot was into the floor because as he was trying to stand up, he was shot dead. And the police just sprayed the apartment, and then walked back and, shot Fred Hampton in the head. He never woke up, and he was, you know, probably drugged. I mean, you can't say for sure, but I would estimate 90% sure that he was drugged because he never even got out of bed. He slept through this fuselage just in his apartment with hundreds and hundreds of bullets, and he never even woke up. So the police just walked back and shot him in the head dead. And his Mark Clark was killed too. Other Panthers were wounded. Hampton's girlfriend, Deborah Johnson, I can't remember what her name is now. She's changed her name. She's still prominent in Chicago too. I think she was 7 or 8 months pregnant at the time. And if my memory serves, I think she got shot too.
And
it was just horrible. Now, this Fred Hampton thing sort of backfired on the police and the FBI because, you know, it makes Panthers look like they're martyrs because you don't need to be a rocket scientist to tell that, you know, this was execution and that there's no return fire. You know, it's just, you know, the police just spraying bullets and then walking back and shooting the man in the head from a distance about 8 inches. While he's unconscious in bed. And so it's just horrible. But it backfires on the police. It creates a lot of political momentum for the Black Panther Party, a lot of sympathy, and so forth. And if you look at the FBI, what the FBI wanted out of this, because they set it all up, it's really hard to tell. It's tempting if you're on the left to say, yeah, the FBI wanted to assassinate Fred Hampton, but I don't really buy that. I think what the FBI wanted was a press conference out of this, and they wanted the police to go in, arrest all these Panthers, you know, and show their shotguns and have photographs of the Panthers and their guns and have a big press conference. But I think the Chicago police just went nuts, you know, and just killed people.
Wow.
You know, but there are lawsuits. I mean, you know, Flint Taylor and other lawyers in Chicago put in lawsuits on behalf of the survivors and then the families of Hampton and Mark Clark, the two people who were killed, and they won their lawsuits.
Yeah, that $1 million settlement for, survivors of Fred Hampton.
Yeah, and by the way, Chicago ain't much better either. The big suit in Chicago today, which you guys should explore maybe some days, this Chicago police named John Berge. He was just arrested by Patrick Fitzgerald had him arrested. You might know that name from the Scooter Libby trial with Dick Cheney and all that, and Valerie Plame Wilson. It's the same prosecutor. But he's being accused, the Chicago police, John Berge, who retired, moved to Florida, of running basically a torture regime in the Chicago Police Department. And,
wow.
Four of the people that were allegedly tortured were sentenced to death.
Wow.
You know, capital punishment. George Ryan, the governor of Illinois then, this is about 10 years ago, commuted the sentences of everybody on death row in Illinois, and he pardoned these four guys who Berge allegedly tortured, and they won, you know, $1 million settlements too, approved by the Chicago City Council by a vote of 45-0.
Wow.
But that's an interesting one to explore, what the hell that guy, pardon my language there, what that guy was up to.
Wow.
And that's still ongoing because he was just indicted, this fellow, Berge. He wasn't indicted for torture, but he was indicted for lying in the course of some of the civil suits that came out of it.
Mm.
Yeah, but that is a wild story. That's truly a big one. And that's going on right now. And you like irony, the governor of Illinois, who's the hero in this, Patrick Fitzgerald prosecuted him, too. He was apparently running a kickback scheme back when he was Secretary of State in Illinois, and he's in federal prison now, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really wanted to get to, again, context of white supremacy with Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, author of Racial Matters. I feel like, I mean, just the information in your book, incredibly comprehensive and thorough. Where you talked about just how the white people at the FBI did an incredible job of amassing information on black people, non-white people who were making an effort to counter racism, white supremacy. And you said on page 339 that with regard to monitoring of financial assets, the FBI overlooked no bank account. Even an account in the low two figures. A spot check at a Chester, Pennsylvania bank revealed a grand total of $44.32 in the name of the National Black Economic Development Conference. I paused and went back and read that again to make sure that my eyes were not fooling me.
Yeah.
A grand total of $44.32.
If you're a group and you got the word black, Negro, colored, anything that suggests race, yeah, they're going to check you out. And that was just standard stuff back then.
Yeah, this said you went on to say the FBI obtained this sort of information routinely through sources at the bank that held the accounts. Such sources were ubiquitous in banks and other protected private sectors and institutions, and they made things easier for field agents. It made no difference whether the Bureau wanted information from a source in a bank or the help of a source in the membership section of the National Rifle Association to purge a black militant member. The FBI mobilized all its resources. And that system, I just kept saying system, exactly what you said at the beginning.
The FBI has informants and sources. The Bureau always called them sources in the National Rifle Association, but they also have informants in the NAACP.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I wouldn't say that today, but I know historically they've had sources in the NAACP.
Yes, sir.
At different points of time, they've also had some, have done some really strange things with very prominent NAACP members from, Walter White to Roy Wilkins. So, the Bureau, they definitely get around. But that's standard FBI stuff under J. Edgar Hoover. And anybody who's prominent, like take an African-American. If an African-American is prominent, they're going to spy on the guy. But if the guy is prominent, they'll also try to make friends with him because he's a famous person. It's what the teenagers call sucking up.
Hmm.
So you get these weird things about the FBI and that they're spying on, say, Walter White or Roy Wilkins like crazy. But they're also doing favors for Walter White and Roy Wilkins because these are, prominent, powerful men. So they're, doing the brown-nosing, too. Now, some activists, the FBI doesn't do that. They don't, try to make nice with Martin Luther King, that's for sure. Okay, and they don't, try to make nice with Huey and Bobby. But for a lot of black activists, the FBI would actually go in two completely opposite directions. They'd spy in the guy, and they'd do favors for him, too.
Wow. Yeah.
That goes, again, for some really famous people. Thurgood Marshall would be an example.
Or
even Earl Warren. Earl Warren's a white man, of course, but Earl Warren, Supreme Court Chief Justice, he handed down some of the really big decisions that affect black America. Brown v. Board of Education is the biggest, but not the only one, right? And Gideon and a whole bunch of other decisions, the Warren Court. And the FBI would, they'd spy on Earl Warren, but they also did favors for him.
Hmm.
And that's pretty, typical.
Wow. I wanted to make sure I got in Jackson State because you included that in your book. I felt that was a really solid example of, in terms of racism, white supremacy, the shooting that happened at Kent State where this is white students, four students were killed, that lots of national sympathy. They have documentaries about what happened there. I've seen documentaries on it. Huge media deal.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, right? Four dead in Ohio. Yeah.
Yes, sir. With what went down at Jackson State, predominantly all non-whites, totally different story in terms of media coverage. Nobody really reports this. This is not really big news. Most people don't really know about this. I even saw a documentary where they were talking about the shooting at Kent State with white students, and they even took, 30 seconds to stop and say at the same, roughly same time period, shooting at Jackson State, nobody really knows about this, where
right.
All these black people are shot at.
There's a lot more bullets at Jackson State, too.
Yes, and in your book, you were talking about this, and you said a confrontation in front of a woman's dormitory.
Well, inside, I think, mostly.
Oh, okay.
Mostly inside, yeah.
Where Mississippi troopers opening fire with rifles, shotguns, and carbines loaded with military ammunition and a submachine gun, some 400 bullets and pieces of buckshot, including armor-piercing shells from two 30.06 rifles, struck the dorm in a 28-second fusillade, killing two black youths, Philip Gibbs, James Green, and wounding 12, and this is in quotes, all nigger gals and nigger males, the police said. The only provocations were words, chants, and obscenities. And I to top this off, Spiro Agnew wanted to blame this on Ralph Abernathy, who I don't even believe was in the area when all this happened. In what you said in your book. Can you talk a little bit more about that incident?
Yeah, Ralph Abernathy, of course, is Martin Luther King's friend. They were together for a long time, since the mid-50s. Yeah, that's that idea of blaming something on something like Spiro Agnew does there, and something extraneous is, you know, it's just goofy. It's like, remember Tom DeLay? Tom DeLay blamed the Columbine massacre on the teaching of evolution in the public schools and Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky. I mean, it's just goofy. And that's what Spiro Agnew down there was doing, goofy. Now, Jackson State, by the way, that's where Walter Payton went to school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the football player for the
Bears.
Chicago Bears. You know, he had that flipper, right? His free hand, he carried the ball one hand, the other arm was like a flipper.
Wow.
And you tried to tackle him, but he was a really good football player.
Yes, sir.
All right, now, Jackson State, yeah, the violence down there is incredible, but I use that in the book, that story, to make a point that things had really changed from the early 60s to the late 60s. And what changed is what happened in between, because, number one, the civil rights movement really took a leftward turn. And, you know, SNCC purged Caucasians and all of this and that, and you get, you know, Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael and all that. And the Panthers are coming up, you know, walking around with shotguns. And then also even Martin Luther King, who remained an integrationist, but Martin Luther King took a real big turn to the left, too, and he started talking about economic equality, and he came north. And so there's a real, you know, radical change in the civil rights movement. And, you know, a lot of, you know, white middle America didn't appreciate that. But, and it wasn't just rhetoric either, because you have to remember, you know, Watts or Newark and Detroit and about 700 other cities experienced, you know, major race rioting. Watts, Newark, and Detroit, those are just the big ones. But you know, about 700 cities exploded in racial violence. And so by the time you get to the late 60s, it's just not, in white middle America, there's not a whole lot of residual sympathy left for the civil rights movement. And so you get that attitude. And the quote you didn't read from that section is from a federal judge, a Kennedy appointee, that, you know, students participating in demonstrations should expect to be injured or killed.
Mm-hmm.
And then to make a jump across the colored line, there's not much sympathy in white middle America for white kids protesting the Vietnam War either, if they get injured or killed.
Mm-hmm.
I know Kent State makes it into the popular culture. That's absolutely true. But it makes it into the, you know, the fringe of the culture. There's not a whole lot of sympathy for those dead students at Kent State in white middle America.
Mm-hmm.
There's sympathy among, you know, with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young in the counterculture. But there's not much sympathy, you know, among hard hat or what Nixon called silent majority culture.
Mm.
So by the late 60s, you're really getting into a, you know, what the political scientists call a big backlash period.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Nixon, a real cynic, and he tried to exploit that. And that's why we got Nixon, by the way, because of that backlash.
Would you say that in your book you titled that White Backlash, would you say that is a response of white people who are upset about non-white people
and
their efforts? Okay.
Yeah, but at the same time, white backlash, it's not something that's born in the 60s. It just sort of flares up. And white backlash has been around, you know, 400 years. It's not a new phenomenon. It just flares up in a big way in the late 60s. And the other thing about so-called white backlash is people like Richard Nixon, the Republican Party, they figure out this is a good way to organize votes. And the big symbol of white backlash is what happens in the South, because white Southerners leave the Democratic Party, the party of Jefferson Davis, and come over to the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln.
Mm.
And that happens in a big way in the 1968 election. And that carries Nixon. But it also carries, you know, Ronald Reagan. It carries the first Bush, the second Bush, because Republicans, as a result of that backlash in the 60s, suddenly have the entire South every presidential election.
Wow. that was one of the big quotes I wanted to ask you about in your book, where Martin Luther King, before this so-called white backlash, said that he feared that the Republican Party would become the white man's party. I wanted to ask you, would it be correct in terms of what he means in saying this, or do you think it's accurate when he says that, to say that the Republican Party is becoming the racist party? Would that be an accurate statement?
Well, I wouldn't. I maybe quibble with that a little bit, but I have no great objection to that. Now, King said that on Meet the Press in 1964.
Yes, sir.
But he's not alone. I mean,
The
50s, Eisenhower worried about that. In fact, the hardest decision Eisenhower said he ever made was sending the 101st Airborne into Little Rock, because that killed Eisenhower's dream of making the Republican Party a white man's party in the South. But that dream gets, you know, resurfaced by people like Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and so forth. Now, it did happen, and that's why one big reason you get the string of all these, very, very conservative, even reactionary presidents, you know, Nixon, Reagan, Bush, and then the second Bush. But at the same time, there's a downside to it for the white South, in that they can get marginalized. And see, that's what Obama's election, I think, did in 2008. And if you look at the country, it's like the white South are being encircled and shrunk. And see, Obama, you know, started picking up Western states. He even took, Virginia and North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
And so that real backlash politics, which was so scary in the 60s when Nixon practiced it and when Reagan practiced it in both Bushes, it suddenly doesn't look so scary anymore. And it seems maybe it's run its course now. On the other hand, it's a long course. It started, in a big way with Barry Goldwater in 1964. And people forget George Bush, the father, the old man. You know, he down in Texas, he voted against the Civil Rights Act in 1964.
Mm.
And so this starts early. It gets its big boost with Watts, Newark, and Detroit, the race riots.
Mm.
And then it really hangs on. I mean, people just forget things. Like when Ronald Reagan ran for president in 1980, he opened his campaign in Neshoba County, Mississippi. That's the county where in 1964, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were lynched and buried under 30 feet of Mississippi mud by the Ku Klux Klan and white sheriffs.
Mm.
And that men who murdered Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman said they were states' rights. And they killed them in the name of states' rights. Well, in 1980, Ronald Reagan goes to Neshoba, Mississippi, and he says, "I am a states' writer."
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. We forget we forget that in 1980, Ronald Reagan, I don't want to pick on Ronald Reagan, but he's a good example of a point I'm trying to make. I mean, he used to tell campaigning in the South, he used to use terms like buck and wench. There's slave auction terms. And he used to tell jokes about, you know, welfare queens and Cadillacs and a big buck online at the grocery store, you know, buying an orange and a big bottle of vodka with food stamps.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not too long ago. In the first Bush, I mean, one reason he beat Dukakis is Willie Horton.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
This guy, and then Willie Horton's name isn't even Willie. His name is William. And a guy named Lee Atwater, a Bush campaign operative, christened him Willie. And, of course, that's the great taboo, right? Willie Horton raped a white woman.
Mm.
So that great taboo of American history. And George H.W. Bush rides that into the White House. I mean, that's just, you know, ugly stuff.
Wow, that going all the way back to Jack Johnson, the sexual intercourse between particularly black males and white females popped up again and again in your book in terms of Mr. Paul Robeson and FBI, their attention to him, and Viola Luiso, and speculation, you know, them continually to play up, you know, she was with a black male.
Yeah, that stuff is ridiculous. Remember the OJ trial?
Yes, sir.
Not the Las Vegas one, but the murder
trial.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
See, a lot of people thought that was funny, not ha-ha funny, but funny in a sad way, because, a black man getting off for killing a white woman. Man, times are changing. And that was, just a strange thing. But see, that's the thing about race. Race in American history has really turned our country on a dime at any particular decade. Race can put us in all these screwy positions. And in our history, sex, black man, white woman, has been the real underlying argument to justify lynching. And as hard as that is to believe today, that's just absolutely true. And on the other hand, it's not that hard to believe even today, because if you look at incarceration rates and average sentences for particular crimes
yes,
committed by blacks and whites,
mm-hmm.
even today, if you take the most extreme crime, a capital crime where you can be executed, the data, and it's just counting numbers, statistics, you still have the best chance of getting a capital sentence, a death sentence, if there's a crime committed by a black man against a white woman.
Wow.
And the numbers are just, off the charts. And if you go into a state like Texas, you can see that. And by the way, but down in Texas, they used to have a phrase as recently as, 15 years ago, referring to misdemeanor murders. Meaning if a black killed a black, or a black
wow.
killed a Mexican, or a white killed a black, they call them misdemeanor murders. But if a black killed a white, or especially if a black killed a white woman, then they were, full blown, not a misdemeanor murder at all. And so
wow.
all this stuff is just so screwy. I actually, feel like an idiot just talking about it, because it's so weird. But that's what race has done to, I think, our country. It's really created a whole bunch of just wild, wild stuff.
Wow.
In my other book, Nixon's Piano, my favorite story about that is James Madison, one of our most famous presidents. And
yes, sir.
Basically wrote the Bill of Rights. I mean, geez. But he was also a slave owner. When Madison was an old man, he dawdling around his plantation down there in Virginia, and Alexis de Tocqueville, the guy who wrote Democracy in America.
Yes, sir.
He comes to visit Madison, and he writes it up, because Madison is just obsessed, and he's saying about how slaves are dangerous, and you got to watch them every minute. They'll just as soon as cut your throat, and they're a real danger to women. And he's just worried about the danger that slaves pose to white women. Okay, so what happens? Madison, he's an old man, he dies, and his widow, right? Dolly Madison. Everybody knows Dolly Madison, right? Well, she's basically busted. She's broke. And guess who's giving her money?
Who?
Well, one of James Madison's slaves, who was freed, he'd given Dolly Madison money out of his own pocket, because she's
wow.
impoverished. And 2 years before that, he's saying, this guy's going to cut my wife's throat. And instead, what's he doing? She's penniless. And here you have a former slave taking pity on Dolly Madison and giving her money out of his own pocket.
Wow. I want to let
out this. By the way, that reminds me, if you have, your listeners ever seen To Kill a Mockingbird or read the book.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that one of the lines in there? Jim, who supposedly raped that young girl in there.
Yes, sir.
And during that trial, what did he say? He said, well, why did you come in and help her? He said, I felt sorry for her.
Yes.
Black
yes.
man feeling sorry for a white woman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he ended up like OJ on trial for,
Willie
not Horton.
Like OJ. No, not like OJ.
Willie
Long.
Horton, excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse
not
me,
like
Willie
OJ
Horton
at all.
For raping a white
yeah.
woman.
Supposedly.
Yeah, he ended up. He killed himself in the book. Or I know he didn't make it out well. The story did not end well for Jim in To Kill a Mockingbird, which racism, white supremacy. You should expect that.
Yeah.
I did want to say with one for our listeners, if you would like to call with a quick question or two, 347-215-6071. I'm gonna look at the switchboard. I did want to point out with the Panthers, and I hear often non-white people and white people talk about them and say, you know, they had all this loony revolutionary rhetoric and off the pigs and all this. I found this quote really interesting. You said in your book, wiretap transcripts show how far removed the Panther reality was from its bloody guerrilla mystique. Some of the things we used to hear on the wiretaps were funny, said William Cohendet, the FBI agent assigned to the Panther squad in San Francisco. It reminded me of Amos and Andy. Fundamentally, I think black people are jovial, happy, and fun-loving. I have seen this type of statement over and over again in different books that talk about the actions of the FBI against the Black Panther Party, that they, listening to these people, often weren't hearing, you know, anything that wild and crazy, that, you know, there was a lot of talk, but in terms of action, at the end of the day, there was really a lot more talk than in terms of them actually going out and brutally taking over the government and killing up a lot of white people or anybody else.
Yeah, well, it's guerrilla theater, it's called. A lot of posturing, a lot of posing in order to get attention. Also, we have to remember that the Panthers are really trying to recruit young people.
Mm.
And in the North, didn't work too well through the churches like it did with King and Abernathy in the South.
Mm.
And so they're trying to recruit young people by, you know, being really aggressive in their rhetoric. And so you have part of that. And also you have that real aggressive rhetoric in order to get the attention of the media.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're in a visual age. I mean, TV is, you know, still new in the 50s. And, you know, TV is still, by today's standards, still even fairly primitive by the late 60s. But we are in the age of the camera. And so groups like the Black Panthers, and not just the Panthers, it's the same thing with the American Indian Movement, right, with
yes, sir,
Russell Means and Dennis Banks and those guys. I mean, a lot of it is visual and drama. You got to do something that attracts the attention of the TV cameras. And also you have to have the rhetoric to make young people, you know, listen to you.
Hmm.
And so that was a lot of the public posturing. But in the background, mostly what the Panthers did, you know, they ran adult literacy programs, and, you know, breakfast programs for poverty-stricken children and all sorts of community health programs. But what happens is the media, and the Panthers didn't mind this at all, that was their whole point, to get media exposure, they focused on the real dramatic things, because yes, occasionally there was a gun battle with the police and things like that, and that's what everybody remembered about the Panthers. They didn't remember the breakfast programs and the adult literacy campaigns and so on.
I'm going to check the switchboard really quick, see if we have any callers, but I did want you to tell the audience about Nixon's Piano, because I have not read that book, but you were telling me about it before the show, and I think that also non-white people should perhaps take a look at that one. Could you share a little bit about Nixon's Piano?
Yeah, Nixon's Piano looks at, again, all the presidents, from George Washington to Bill Clinton, and I try to organize it not so it's a book of lists, but so it's a coherent story, and it looks at all those presidents and how they dealt with color line issues. So the first third of the book is about the slavery period. And then, since my main interest in history is 20th century, the last two-thirds of the book are from Teddy Roosevelt up through Bill Clinton. And the title of the book is kind of strange. Why do I call it Nixon's Piano? And the title comes from a piano duet that Richard Nixon and his vice president, Spiro Agnew, did at the Gridiron Club in Washington. And the Gridiron Club, that's like a roast. And, you know, famous politicians and media people, you know, get up there and they make fun of each other. And Nixon and Agnew, in doing their piano duet, they made fun of their own Southern strategy. And Nixon's Southern strategy was part of this big campaign to bring the White South over to the Republican Party. And the piano duet was hilarious, but again, not in a ha-ha way, in that the media just roared with laughter, but the piano duet was actually really, really ugly, because Nixon was a straight man, and Agnew spoke in what used to be called darky dialect.
Wow.
Yes, sir, boss, that kind of
thing. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, like with that film Spike Lee did not too long ago about stereotypes, you know, from Aunt Jemima to everything else.
Oh, Bamboozled.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and,
yes,
and that's, so you hear you have the Vice President of the United States doing a piano duet, and he's speaking in darky dialect.
Wow.
That's kind of weird. And so that's why I called the book Nixon's Piano.
Nick, that is on my reading list. I hope everyone out there check that one out as well. But read Racial Matters first. I think that's very pertinent. We have a lot of callers, actually. 414, are you there?
Yes, I'm just listening.
Oh, okay.
I don't have a question.
No problem. Thank you for tuning in. Appreciate it. 267, are you there?
Yes, Hotep, greetings. I'm here listening in.
Oh, RNA, right on. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate it. Thank you both for lips. If you don't have questions, I will. We have a couple people online checking the show out.
I have a few questions. Like I said, I might start showing some emotion. It's just very interesting for me how you, Mr. O'Reilly, talk about these huge and horrific acts of injustice. With seeming very little feeling attached at all. And I'm just curious, as I'm listening to you, what do you feel as you recall these horrible events? And maybe they weren't so horrible for you because they weren't not happening to you and your people, per se, you know, or it was happening on a different level on the other end of the spectrum. Yet I'm just really curious about what do you feel when you kind of come face to face with such horrific and horrendous acts.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you, it's somewhat ironic that you bring that point up, because I'm a historian. That's my profession. I have a PhD in history and all this stuff. And in, within the context of my profession, I'm often criticized for exactly the opposite of your point, for getting too involved emotionally and for caring too much. And so I don't want to say it's all relative, but I hear what you're saying, and I see that as somewhat ironic, because, again, in my profession, my problem is often identified by other historians as I'm too emotionally involved. Now, in terms of my personal background, yeah, like I said up front, my background is Irish, and my grandparents, they saw a lot of Irish people hung in their day, and all the way down to, you know, seven, eight, nine-year-old boys, you know, hung in Ireland. And so I think a lot of people in the world today have gone through, you know, horrible things. Few people in the world have gone through something as horrible as slavery. That's absolutely, positively true. And again, will a white person fully understand that? Absolutely not. On the other hand, can anybody understand slavery today? That type of chattel slavery? Because the world is pretty much shed of that sort of slavery. We still have some fairly horrific forms of slavery in certain parts of the world today, but we don't have chattel slavery anymore anywhere, and so that's progress. Now, in terms of my personal view and why I don't get real emotional about this stuff, I think I'd go nuts if I did, and so I've got to basically sort of try to keep an even keel about it.
Yes. Yeah, I guess that's why they teach you in school, or they teach us, because I've also gone through the process of obtaining a PhD, and one of the key elements in all research is objectivity.
Correct.
And I imagine it's that objectivity that allows you to sort of stand back and just simply study what's been going on and not necessarily feel
a strong connection or subjective experience.
Yeah. Well, remember what I said. Most of my peers, they don't have that view of me. They think I'm just too wrapped up and too emotionally involved in my material.
No, I want you to stay on the line because I'm going to let you get you to get another one. I just wanted to get 520 to get a quick question in, and then I'm going to go back to you, RNA. 520, do you have a question? 520? Oh, he's not there. RNA, you can go ahead and shoot your question. I thought 520 was there.
Mr. O'Reilly is suggesting that while there's not chattel slavery going on, and that in some ways represents progress, I say for myself and for my unique position, being a woman of African descent here in this country, it seems that the current form. Yeah, but hello, is that 520 now? Hello.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, I heard somebody else. That the form of slavery that we have going on now seems to be much more insidious and much more detrimental and dangerous, because while it's not, it's just more covert now, and so then it's harder to sort of see and study and much harder to prove, as opposed to the whip. There seems to be other things that sort of leave no mark, yet you know you've been stung by something, but the mark is not there. And because it's so sort of insidious and seemingly embedded in the psyche of people, to me, I would say that there hasn't been much progress, and if there's any progress, it certainly has not been beneficial for people of African descent.
Well, I disagree with you a little bit. No matter what, a country like the United States with chattel slavery and then the United States without chattel slavery, we're a better country. Just that alone. We're better for whom?
Again, the question becomes better for whom?
Well, for everybody.
From the trauma that happened to us during the course of chattel slavery, do you believe that it would be necessary for healing to happen?
I have no problem with that. What I'm saying is, no matter what, there has been progress. Chattel slavery is abolished. Legal racism, Jim Crow, is abolished. Now, just because there's progress made, does that mean things are perfect? Absolutely not. But at least there's no more chattel slavery and legal racism. Now, the issue we have today, and again, my field is history, so let me try to show how we look at it in history. If you ask 100 people today what the major color line problem is, you might get 100 different answers. But if you ask 100 people today and you say, hey, 200 years ago, what was the major color line problem? They probably all say slavery. Or if you ask them, what was the major color line problem 50 years ago, they probably all say Jim Crow. In other words, today there's no consensus on what the number one color line problem is. But guess what? Historically, there was no consensus either at the time. In other words, in slavery days, a lot of people in America, a lot of white people, thought slavery is a solution, not a problem. And during Jim Crow days, a lot of white people in America thought Jim Crow was a solution, not a problem. Now, today, only a few crazy white people think slavery and Jim Crow were good things. There's a consensus on this country, in this country. This country did the right thing in killing slavery and killing Jim Crow. But again, remember, at the time, there's no such consensus at all. And so what I'm saying is, today, the very fact that our country can't come to a consensus about what the number one racial problem is, and in fact, probably a majority of the country thinks there are no more racial problems. I disagree with that, but I think that's a very common attitude in America. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it won't sort out over time, and we won't come to some consensus about what the next dragon to slay is on the color line. And there have been two big dragons slain so far, slavery and Jim Crow. What's the next big dragon to be slain? Again, we can't even find them yet.
Oh, I have a big dragon since I'm.
Well, of course you do. But that's my. That's my point. You
right,
have
but
yours.
I wanted to illustrate.
I have mine. The caller
right.
has hers.
But what I wanted to illustrate.
Another 100 people have 100 different dragons too. But to
right,
slay
but
a dragon, you have to have a consensus.
Very important. I feel the cause of so-called apartheid, so-called formal slavery. At the end of the day, we're still talking about the system of white supremacy. That's what we should trying to be replace. That's the effort we should be making to replace the system of white supremacy with a system of justice. Jim Crow and all this other, all these other things are symptoms of what is really the dominant problem that we should all be working to replace, in my view, and I could be incorrect.
No,
and I wanted to say 520's here, but yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. But,
okay.
But what I'm saying is, no matter whether I agree with you or not, that's not how progress gets made. See, if you look historically, slavery's abolished, Jim Crow's abolished, and this country didn't abolish slavery because the majority of this country was worried about black people being slaves. And this country didn't abolish Jim Crow because the majority of this country was worried about black people sitting in the back of a bus. This country abolished slavery because the majority of white people realized slavery hurt them. And Jim Crow's abolished because the majority of white people realized that that type of legal, institutionalized racism hurts them too. In other words, every time we made big progress, white people have realized racism hurts them too. In fact, if you look at Abraham Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln has one underlying message from about 1830 to 1865 when he's assassinated. And that message is slavery degrades all labor. And that message means slavery is a threat to the American dream, because the American dream says, hey, you work hard, you'll be a success. And how do you reconcile that with slavery? And so Lincoln's message is slavery is a disaster for white people. The enslavement of African Americans is a disaster for white Americans. That's Lincoln's message. And I think if we're going to make big color line progress in the future, you got to sign up a lot of white people. You got to make a lot of white people see that racism hurts them too. And I think if you look at a modern leader like Jesse Jackson had been pushing that message since the 70s, that institutional racism is a disaster, not just for blacks. It's a disaster for most white people. Most white people ain't Bernie Madoff or Bill Gates, right? One's a crook, one's not, but they're both filthy, stinking rich. Or at least one of them was. That's Jesse Jackson's message, that racism hurts white people. And that was Abraham Lincoln's message 150 years ago. Slavery hurts white people. I think if progress...
That's very different. Wait a minute. That's very different what you just said. You said racism hurts white people. You said Mr. Lincoln's message was slavery, not racism. That is a very different thing.
Well, sure,
because you can end slavery and not end the system of racism.
No, you can. Why can't you? Sure, you can end racism. Racism, you tell.
Oh, that's not what I said. I said you can end slavery without ending the system of racism.
Well, of course,
white supremacy.
Because it took the Second Reconstruction to get rid of Jim Crow 100 years after slavery died. Of course, that's right.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, I'm talking about progress. And ending slavery is color line progress. Ending Jim Crow is color line progress. And in both cases, progress came because a lot of white people signed on too. And again, a lot of white people signed on not because they were worried about, what slavery was doing to blacks, but because they were worried about what slavery is doing to their opportunities. And a lot of white people signed on in the 60s with Martin Luther King and them, because they were worried about what institutional racism, Jim Crow, legal racism was doing to, their opportunities in America.
Yes, sir.
So
can I say this?
Sure.
Wait
a minute. Can we get 520 in? Because I think I did get him back. 520, are you there? He's still not there. Go ahead, racism. RNA.
No, I was going to say I am a social scientist, and I'm a practitioner. I'm a clinician in the social service arena. I'm also consider myself a traumatologist. And from the field of traumatology and clinical work in the emotional health, behavioral health arena, it is imperative, it is a prerequisite. Telling the truth about terrible events is a prerequisite for restoration of social order and for healing of individual members.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that, yeah.
And when, and it is my contention that because there has been no opportunities for folks of African descent to tell the truth about the terrible events that we experienced here in America, and I must say for myself, I've been able to trace my ancestral family to a plantation that was owned by the Irish and run by the Irish. My maiden name is an Irish name. So what we've experienced here in America, we have not had an opportunity to heal from the impact of those terrible events. And because we haven't had the impact, the opportunity to heal from that experience, and neither for that case have whites, it seems, that the nature of the illness, you know, the trauma and the responses to trauma continue, and then there is still a system in place that penalizes and punishes people for the symptoms that are manifest as a result of the trauma that we have experienced and that we continue to experience. So for me, that does not equate with progress. It just shifted stuff, and it just pushed it underground, and it put a nice Band-Aid on it by saying, okay, slavery is illegal here. Jim Crow is illegal. However, everything in this system is still designed and set up as a slave system. If I work every day and I earn time off, in order for me to take it, I have to have it approved. And most often than not, the person who is in the position to approve or disapprove it is a white person. And this is a white person who believes that we're all on equal footing, and they've not had a chance to tell the truth about the terrible events that them and their ancestors engaged in. And we haven't had an opportunity to tell the truth about the terrible events, and therefore there's been no healing. So, you know, we just have a pretty sick society, it seems to me. And that's all, you know, I wanted to add to it at this point.
Thank you. Zakir, are you there? I don't know what's going on with my switchboard. I
think there was somebody on 347.
Oh, okay. I'll see if 347 is there. Hold on one second.
Hello?
Three, four, seven, are you there?
Peace, you can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Nat Turner, 187.
Oh, right on. Thank you. Thank you for hanging in. I'm glad I was able to get you on the phone this time. My apologies for before. Please, do your thing, sir.
I thought you was trying to make me the invisible man again.
No disrespect. Go right ahead. It's your world.
And it's kind of appropriate to, you know, kind of the conversation, you know, just like Sister Abner was just saying, you know, I think that, you know, some of the things that were said in regards to slavery being over, Jim Crow being over, to me, I don't feel like it's over because, you know, yes, the issue is that all of the things that was done was never resolved. There was no repairing done of all the damage that was done over hundreds of years. So, you know, to, you know, have somebody come and say, you know, oh, it's over because what? Because you say it's over? Because Caucasians say it's over? You know?
Well, slavery's over because it's over. It doesn't matter what you say or what I say. It's over. And Jim Crow is over. And it doesn't matter what you say or I say. It's over. And that, you can say that that's sham progress, but most people would say it's you know, it's real progress. And you just have to remember what chattel slavery was like. Chattel slavery, you're a slave, your children are slaves, your grandchildren are slaves, and it's forever. And your family can, you know, can be broken up at the whim of a master. The master
all of that still goes on today. It's done through the courts. Okay?
Pardon me?
Well, I say it's done through the courts. We got a woman right now who's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who's had her child taken from her, okay, and she's in prison with a $24,000 bail. And that's just one case out of many that happens every day.
That's a difference.
It's amazing how, you know, some people tend, you know, and when I say some people, I'm talking about especially Caucasian people tend to think that just because they say something, that's what it is. That's your reality. Just like looking at this situation in off the coast of Kenya with the Somalians, okay, to Americans or to Caucasians, oh, they're pirates, okay? To me and to other Africans, that's the Somalian Coast Guard, okay, protecting their waterways.
Well, I'm in history. So in history, what we know is that the United States, since the days of Thomas Jefferson, had been fighting pirates in North Africa 200 years. I mean, one of the this nation's first wars, about 20-year undeclared naval war against
the pirates. The same way that Europeans came over here and took the land from the Indians. Okay, y'all are pirates to them, okay? So what are you saying?
I'm having a hard time following you.
Your mindset is based in one sphere of your brain that sees only a European perspective, okay? And I ain't really called here to get into no argument with you about that per se, but, you know, listening to some of the stuff that's going on and then, you know, to continue to, you know, kind of sweep stuff under the rug, you know, by saying certain things, you know, I don't agree with that.
Well, the Barbary Pirate War is 200 years old, and what I was trying to do is give a little historical perspective. The United States and other countries have had conflict with pirates in North Africa for hundreds of years.
Most
countries have basically paid bribes, and the United States has rarely, we have sometimes, but rarely paid bribes.
But all of that is off point. The point is, though, you know, that I'm making, just like talking about the Somalis in particular, since you want to talk about pirating and all of that.
Well,
okay,
you brought pirating up. I didn't bring it up.
Well, what's being done right now? You got people who are in these different companies that basically take toxic waste, just like the Italians. You know, somebody mentioned earlier today talking about how the Italians were once at the Fulton Fish Market in New York, so they got driven out of that. So they've already had.
Well, you've lost me again. I'm completely lost.
Well, just pay attention and listen. If you listen, maybe you pick it up.
No, I don't.
You keep cutting me off, and it's like, you know, if you want to understand something, maybe you should listen.
Well, I'm not sure it's pick upable. I can't follow.
Well, it's not hard to believe because that's the history of Caucasians. You understand that part?
No.
Of course you don't.
Well, I mean, what I'm hearing is rhetoric, but I'm not hearing.
Yeah, it's rhetoric to you. Let me ask you something on the issue of the FBI, because some of the stuff you were saying is if nowadays, oh, the FBI is like, oh, it's a big change and things are different, as if COINTELPRO doesn't exist. Is that what you're trying to tell people today?
Did you hear what I said? That's not what I said.
I heard. I'm asking you. That's why I'm asking.
All right,
what do you think I'm asking you for?
Well, you asked me a yes or no question. Let me explain it again. What my point was about the FBI. The FBI has a good side and a bad side, like a lot of people, a lot of institutions. And a lot of what the FBI does is legitimate criminal work. The FBI has also had a very controversial side, where they do political work. And in my course of the last 30 years, I've written like 4 books about the FBI, and I've concentrated on their political side. I looked at the FBI McCarthyism, the FBI and African Americans, and I haven't found much to admire. On the other hand, I will give the FBI this credit. On occasion, at least, and often very begrudgingly, they will investigate civil rights cases. I mean, they investigate the Rodney King beating, for example. And Rodney, you know, the police officers who beat Rodney King can be tried on state level, but they can also be tried, on federal civil rights violation as well. And that often happens. You mentioned Milwaukee. In a case in Milwaukee, there was a beating of a guy named Frank Jude by Milwaukee police, and the FBI investigated that, and those police were prosecuted in federal court for depriving this fellow, Frank Jude, of his civil rights by beating him to a pulp, you know, a la Rodney King. And so, yes, the FBI has done a lot of extremely questionable, horrific stuff on the color line. At the same time, the FBI has done, at least occasionally, some good stuff on the color line.
So the question
and
was...
And that doesn't minimize the bad stuff the FBI did. It doesn't minimize it at all. It just goes to show they're like anybody else. They're human. If you take, like, an individual criminal who's done horrific crimes, an individual human being, that doesn't mean, you know, every act they do is criminal. People are like that. You have to, and institutions are like that. You have to look at the whole of the thing. Now, what defines the whole? In my case, what defines the whole of the FBI during the J. Edgar Hoover era is the politics, the ugly stuff, the horrible stuff. But even during that era, yeah, the FBI did occasionally do some good work.
So it kind of sounds like you are in defense for the FBI.
Oh, not because at all. I just used words. I just used words like horrible.
Question was, do you think COINTELPRO, do you think it's still in effect today?
Are there disruptive activities? Yeah, absolutely. But that particular program is not, that program was terminated in 1971. Disruptive activities, counterintelligence activities still going on in the FBI? Sure. I have no doubt about that. But that particular program is not going on. That particular program is killed.
Would you say it's accurate? Because you said earlier that the FBI, they see black people, all black people, as dangerous because of the system of racism. Do you think that feeling is still there, and do you think they would still function in the same manner to oppose any non-white people who make an effort to counter racism, white supremacy?
You mean nowadays? No, I don't see that at all nowadays. You don't have that, like in my book, Racial Matters, I talked about community surveillance programs, and I really seriously doubt you have that type of stuff going on. But you do still have this, you know, this political targeting. And by the way, it's not confined to minorities either. I mean, a classic example might be Elliot Spitzer, the governor of New York, and that prostitution sting. I mean, it's really embarrassing and all that stuff. But he was not indicted. There's no crime there. And yet he's resigned as governor of New York. And why did the FBI go after that fellow? You know, what's up with that? That's a political prosecution. And see, if you want to make a COINTELPRO parallel, that's a good case to make it. And there are other cases like that. But historically, though, there's a difference between the type of politicization that's going on now and the type of formal program the FBI did under COINTELPRO.
Do you think non-white people who are making an effort to replace white supremacy with justice, if they gather any momentum, do you think it would be logical for them to expect the same sort of actions that the FBI and enforcement officials conducted during the so-called civil rights movement, to expect the same type of behavior?
Well, yeah, people, if you do something, people will push back. People will come back at you. And government bureaucracies are no different than if you get in a feud with your next-door neighbor. You might be pushing on each other. They will, yeah, they will do that. The difference is if you catch them, you can sue them nowadays. And that happens quite a bit. Our government is paying all sorts of damages. When George, for example, when George Bush was first inaugurated after the Florida recount in 2000, he was inaugurated January 2001, there were demonstrations at his inauguration, and there's a lot of police violence at his inauguration, and the police paid damages, almost $1 million, for beating people up at his inauguration. So it's different today. I mean, see, that's one reason, you know, that I'm in history. That's my profession. I'm an historian. And one thing historians do, we look at change in time. We don't say history repeats itself. That's a cliche, and it's not true. Things always change. But a lot of people who are not historians, and I'm not saying historians are better than anybody else. We're certainly not. But we do study change in time. So we're always interested in how things change, okay, and how things are different. When we're not interested in saying, well, things are always the same. That's not what we do. We look at change in time. And so when I look at the FBI during the Hoover era, the FBI in the post-Hoover era is different, period, end of story. Now, do they do certain things that are similar and controversial and political? Absolutely. But it's still a different bureaucracy. It's a different agency. And the FBI, again, under J. Edgar Hoover, you know, is just a lot different than it is under Robert Mueller. And I bet most of your listeners couldn't name who the FBI director is today. But they're definitely a lot different today than they were under Hoover.
Mr. Nat Turner. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to ask Mr. Nat Turner. Did you have another question? I hopped in with two. Did you have another question or comment?
I think Sister Abner wanted to say something, or she was trying to say something. The mic might be closed.
Oh, okay, I'll go back to get her. I wanted to ask, I saw a question in the chat room. Someone asked, who is responsible for policing COINTELPRO activities in the FBI or just any sort of program that runs in that manner? Who is responsible for overseeing and policing that?
Well, during the COINTELPRO era, which ran 1956 to 1971, that's an interesting question, because the FBI didn't really tell the Attorney General what they were doing, and it's not clear how much the Attorney General knew. The Attorney General's in charge of the Justice Department. FBI is part of the Justice Department. Nowadays, the pecking order would go, if there's a complaint, the pecking order would first go to a Inspector General in the Justice Department. I think that guy today's name's Glenn Fine. And so right now, his office, the Inspector General's office, they're doing that type of work now. For example, some of their big projects right now have to do with the U.S. Attorney purge. They have to do with NSA warrantless wiretapping. And they have to do with torture, you know, enhanced interrogation at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and the CIA's black sites. So that first level of review, if an agency like the FBI is, not up to snuff, would be through the Justice Department's Inspector General. Then you also have congressional committee hearings. You can have a commission appointed to investigate. And also you can have civil or even criminal lawsuits brought against the FBI. And again, the FBI has been sued a lot. We mentioned earlier this evening the Fred Hampton survivors, the families of the survivors and the families of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark who were killed. They sued the FBI and they won. A guy named Donald Roshan, a black man who's an FBI agent, he sued the FBI on the grounds that the FBI, he was an agent, and he sued on the grounds that the FBI was discriminating against black agents. For example, he'd come into work, and someone would cut the faces off. He'd have a photograph on his desk of his family, his wife and children, and he'd come into work the next morning. The faces would be cut off, and someone would glue the heads of monkeys on his wife and his children. You know, stuff like that, racism. And so he sued. And so that's another option, you know, the lawsuits. On the other hand, lawsuits usually are a last option. You have to be, you know, really brave or crazy to sue somebody, especially, you know, a big agency that has a lot of resources. But all these avenues can go through, and sometimes it's not, you know, they don't lead to real good resolutions. I mean, a lot of people had high hopes for Barack Obama, and he's done a lot of amazing things now. But another thing, he sort of punted NSA wiretapping, the torture issue, state secrets issues, and all sorts of stuff like that. Obama sort of punted.
I wanted to check really quick because my switchboard is acting a little funny. 520, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Can you hear me?
Rock and roll. Yes, sir. We got you. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I was just wondering, as far as Marcus Garvey, wasn't his whole goal really about repatriating back to Africa? And why would that concern the FBI if that were the case? I think I have my own answer to that, and that would simply be that you can't practice racism without non-white people. That would be my answer, but I was wondering why they were so opposed to him. And also, with regard to the political aspect of the scapegoating and the welfare queens and whatnot, really that still goes on to this day, at least in the presidential elections. You heard, Bill Clinton, he talked about ending welfare as we know it, and, you know, Ricky Rector, and even Barack Obama would talk about cold Popeye's chicken and so forth. That kind of thing still goes on, and the scapegoating and whatnot. That kind of stuff still goes on. I was wondering, though, primarily about my Marcus Garvey question. What you thought about that?
Yeah, Garvey, he wasn't always pushing the Back to African movement, but he did push that in the 20s especially. And by the way, that has some roots. That before the Civil War, even Lincoln briefly signed on to that one. And, you know, Monrovia, sending black people in America, slave and free, back to Africa. So that one has, you know, old roots. And that's one reason Garvey ended up negotiating with the Ku Klux Klan, because I'm sure the Klan wouldn't have minded back to Africa for blacks either. But that's not, you know, the specific issue, back to Africa, is not why the FBI had a problem with Marcus Garvey. The FBI had a problem with Marcus Garvey because he showed the potential of political organization of black people in this country. And so the issue is really secondary. The problem is, you know, black people being organized politically, and that makes them a bigger threat. Okay. Now, the logistics of going back to Africa, that the FBI didn't take that seriously. No one really did. I mean, that's just not going to happen. And that, by the way, is what really brought Garvey down, because it's sort of a ridiculous campaign, and yet he's, using the U.S. mail to raise money for that campaign. And that really is how the FBI found an issue, which they could prosecute Garvey on, you know, mail fraud and all that stuff.
Oh, also, sorry, one other thing. Don't you think, given a lot of the actions that have taken place, don't you think that Barack Obama was installed as a way of lulling lulling the public back to sleep, and that he's really a tool of the racist structure.
Well, I don't know.
Don't you think? Look at the actions that he's taking. He's basically covering for the gangster class, the ruling class, basically using him as sort of a shield, as a person that people can trust. You know, run the black guy in there,
well,
and get everyone to.
Well, Obama got elected, and he got elected because he had a real big grassroots organization. A lot of young people turned out to vote for him. I mean, he got votes.
But, don't you think he's here to sort of refine the system of racism? All the things that have happened that you talk about are all refinements. Getting rid of overt racism, getting rid of slavery, those are all refinements. But the underlying issue is still in place.
I still have trouble.
And with regard,
I agree that.
Go ahead.
I agree there's still a problem of race, but saying getting rid of slavery is a refinement. I mean, we had, you know, Civil War battles like Cold Harbor. You had 3,000 or 4,000, you know, Union troops, all white boys, dying in like 20 minutes to end slavery. That's not a refinement. That's something that's rather dramatic. Now, as far as Obama, I have the same concerns about, especially what he's doing with the bankers. And part of me has a little bit, not much, but a little bit of sympathy for him, because the banking industry, finance, right now that's the big engine in our economy. Now, I think that's a disgrace, but the fact of the matter is finance is the big engine in our economy. It used to be factory production. Before that, it used to be cotton production. Before that, it used to be tobacco. But right now, it's money, finance. And so he's a little hesitant. But on the bright side, I would say this. If the economy doesn't turn around, I think Obama will become more radical. And see, Franklin Roosevelt did the same thing. If you look at Roosevelt when he came in, the 100 days, the first New Deal, it wasn't all that innovative or radical. It didn't really push structural change. But the Depression didn't go away, so Roosevelt came back with the second New Deal. And the second New Deal did push a lot more type of structural change into the economy, help build the labor unions and the middle class and all that stuff. So I'm trying to be optimistic about Obama, and I think that's what will happen. Of course, the flip side of that is if the economy doesn't get better in a couple years, maybe the Republican Party will come roaring back, and I think that would be a disaster.
Right. What I would say that what we would need would be a complete overhaul of the entire economic system, but that's for another day. I'll just add one other thing, is I disagree about the class versus race argument. I would say that race is the very foundation. You know, racism is far more destructive than poverty is. You know, poverty doesn't take away your initiative and self-reliance. That's exactly what racism does. I would also say that assets transfer. You know, all these years, all the assets were transferred from slavery. Fannie Mae Foundation did a study, and that we're talking about trillions of dollars, even with just a 6% interest rate. So I would say that racism is the foundation, and I would also add that just not being black, even Indians, from India, the fact that they are not black is a form of currency as well. So I would say that race is the underlying issue leads to poverty.
Yeah, I have no problem with that either. But my point, I see my point is actually being more radical than that, because I see racism as a tool, not merely, let's put it in simple terms, use the word theft or to steal. Racism is not merely a tool to steal from blacks. I think racism is used as a tool to steal from whites, because there's just more of them. We got more money. And so, I mean, if you're a corrupt businessman, member of the elite, you know, the system and all that stuff, right? That's a big 60s word, the system. I mean, who do you want to steal from? Someone who doesn't have money or someone who does? And I think racism is used as a tool to allow theft from white people as well. And see, that's why I think Jesse Jackson is one of the, you know, really, truly most radical people we've had around in American politics for a long time. Because that's his basic argument. You know,
that doesn't make sense, because what would prompt a white person to vote against their self-interest other than race? You're saying that it's about money, right, but it's about race because they're voting against their self-interest.
Let me put it a different way. Take unemployment. Our society defines full employment as roughly, you know, 4 or 5% unemployed. In other words, our society sees it as a good thing that we have a permanent pool of unemployed. Now, the reason our society sees that as a good thing is to control inflation. And for example, it's a bad time now to make a comparison, but just jump back a few years. What if unemployment dropped to 0%? Everybody got a job. What would happen? Well, bankers would drive up interest rates, so unemployment would come back up to 5%. So the question is, why does our society think it a good thing to have a permanent pool of unemployed people, roughly 5% of the population? Well, simple answer, to control inflation, to keep wages down. Okay, now let's break that out into white and black. Are black Americans disproportionately represented in the unemployed, permanent unemployed pool or the permanent employed pool?
Of course.
Black unemployment rates are much higher than white unemployment rates. And white people are disproportionately represented in the 95% of Americans who have jobs. Blacks are disproportionately represented in the 5% of Americans who don't have jobs. But remember, the purpose of having a permanent pool of unemployed is to keep wages down. And so whose wages do you need to keep down? You don't need to keep down the people who are unemployed. They ain't making anything. So you need to keep down whose wages? The other 95% who are employed.
Okay, well, what more is it going to take?
Racism is a tool to do in that definition, and again, this is Jesse Jackson's basic argument. See, racism is a tool to keep the wages of white middle America under control.
I understand that. So, but what more is it going to take for white middle America to quote unquote hitch their wagon with blacks? It's beneath.
Yeah. Now you're.
Why would I hitch my wagon with a black? He's beneath me.
Yeah. That's right. And see what you just said there. That's exactly my argument. Once you can, white middle America makes a connection that racism hurts me too, then you're going to have some progress on a particular issue, and sometimes even on a big issue like slavery or Jim Crow. But until that comes, the progress is hard to make, because white guilt isn't going to get you very far, especially nowadays, because white middle America, they're not doing so hot now at all. And so white middle American guilt is not going to fly at all nowadays, because the white middle class are under tremendous pressure themselves. The fact that they're not under as much pressure as the lower classes, that's really irrelevant. White middle America under pressure is not going to feel the least bit of guilt or the least bit of responsibility about creating a just society. What you have to do is make white middle America see that things like racism, things like crazy wars on terror, adventurism abroad, these imperial adventures, that hurts us. And once that connection can be made, we will have some progress.
Much longer do you think that's going to take? And do you think, generally speaking, that the system of white supremacy is on the wane or waxing?
I think in the long run it's waxing because of demographics. You look at Barack Obama's election. I mean, people say this and that. Pretty much anybody would have won against Bush. I mean, he was so bad. The Bush-Cheney regime was just so horrible. On the other hand, George Bush still did real good among white voters. But he didn't do good among white voters under Bernie.
He still didn't win. He still didn't win the majority of the white vote.
No, he did.
Barack Obama did not win the majority.
That's what I just said.
Okay, I thought you said he did.
No, he wanted for white voters under 30, but he didn't do well at all among white voters total. Okay, so why did Barack Obama win? Well, because George Bush is so bad. I mean, pretty much anybody could have beat him. But the other thing is demographic changes. And, they are coming, and they're global. They're not just us. Demographic changes are global. But one thing, if people pay attention to globalization and the world economy, a lot of these wheelers and dealers in the world today, a lot of them are white, but a lot of them are not white, too. I mean, greed is great.
I think you have a small group of what I would call buffers. If you look at China, they have over 1.2 billion people, but 0.2 billion of those people are the ones that actually have money. The other billion live in abject poverty.
Oh, yeah, no problem with that. But I'm saying, if you look at the wheelers and dealers in the global economy, they ain't all white guys. That's the nature of globalization. And China's a perfect example. China basically owns us now. They bought some.
I just wanted to clarify. You did say you think the system of white supremacy is waxing. How or what is it that you see that suggests?
Demographics. I mean, demographic changes in the United States. I mean, if you look at the Republican Party today, what some Republicans are trying to do is start a debate inside the Republican Party about how to respond to these demographic changes in the United States. Where, I mean, who would have thunk of it? I mean, forget the fact that an African American is elected president of the United States. Forget that for a minute. Who would have ever thunk that a candidate could lose the white vote and still become still get elected president? I mean, that's as mind-boggling as the election of a black man in the first place.
So, I don't think it's that as remarkable as people make it out to be. Look at what he ran on. He didn't run on redressing any grievances or anything. He ran away from those issues. He didn't. He ran a. I'm sorry.
Yeah, your line is on. If you could hold down for a little bit. Yo, you're good. Thank you. 520.
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. So I'm just saying, I know it's a feel-good story and whatnot, but what you were saying earlier about Sam Neill is Barack Obama is their guy. He's the guy that they wanted in there. He wasn't saying any. He scapegoats blacks in order to compensate. Look at what Bill Clinton ran on. I said earlier, is about blaming blacks for all the ills and saying it's welfare, and they strategically ran on that. His only accomplishments were co-opting Republican policies. You know, it's not as there's a long way to go in what you're saying in terms of hitching their wagon. It's not. I don't see that happening. I think that the race. I think not being black being a measuring stick. Saying that I am not black is a form of currency.
Yeah, but at the same time, you've got these two realities. Reality number one is a black man is president of the United States. Reality number two is the current president of the United States lost the white vote, and he's still president. And so as an historian, I look at that, and the big thing that jumps out at me is some big demographic changes going on in the United States.
Well, what does that mean for blacks? The fact that there's a black face in a high place, it means more to whites than it does to blacks. Because to whites, it's a way of forgiving for all the ills of the past. I don't want to hear about them anymore. For blacks, it's okay. It has really no impact, really, at all.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, not for me. I can't speak for blacks. I like to say
that Obama lost.
There's no tangible impact.
Yeah, but again, what historians do, we look at specific things. Obama lost the white vote, but he got like 98% of the black vote. So,
I understand that, but see, that's kind of a catch-22. If blacks hadn't voted for Obama overwhelmingly, they'd have been accused of being crabs in a barrel. You know, here you guys have a chance. When you're old in the White House, you can't even stick together.
Here's another fact. Obama would have been elected president with no black votes. He still would have won.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Hold on one second. I didn't feel like I got the question answered. If my understanding is correct, waxing means getting stronger. So I never really felt like I got it clarified as to why Dr. O'Reilly feels the system of white supremacy is getting stronger.
Yeah, I misunderstood you. I thought you said waning.
Okay. So do you feel it's getting stronger or getting weaker?
I would guess it's getting weaker because of demographics and globalization. I mean, the world is not predominantly white.
It never has been. That's right.
But we've never had the degree of globalization in the world economy that we're having in the last 20, 30 years. And so I think that is, in other words, racism for a lot of the true wheelers and dealers in global financial markets is, gets in the way. It's a handicap. So I think overall, white hegemony is on the decline. I don't think it'll fracture and break anytime soon, but it's not as strong as it's been.
Well, wouldn't that be based? I think it's based on military or violence, because I think as that begins to wane, I think you'll see a leveling out. For example, with the Pol Pirot issue, we know that is just those people were overwhelmed by military force. So I think what enforces what you see around the world, what enforces is the military. That backs it up. So I think that it's going to be proportional to, you have deceit and you have violence. Those two things have to work in harmony for the system of white supremacy to continue. Would you agree with that, sir?
I'm not sure. I would. The violence is often counterproductive. I mean, you can take an incident which, on its own terms, now symbolically, I can agree with you, but on its own terms, you have this teeny tiny incident that can be solved by Navy SEAL snipers, at least this one, abduction of a captain of a ship. But, I mean, violence ain't working out so well in Iraq. It ain't working out so well in Afghanistan. And if we had responded, and violence wouldn't even work out so well for Al-Qaeda in 9/11 if we hadn't responded in such a loopy way. Violence is not necessarily a useful tool for any hegemony. It can be self-defeating, self-destructive. I mean, violence, you can make a case today that violence has brought America to its knees. That we're overextended.
Well, it's not at its knees, because if it was at its knees, it wouldn't be able to send out all these Navy ships. There are thousands of bases all over the world, and that's going to be here for a while.
Oh, yeah, and we've got MREs, meals ready to eat, dug 200 feet under the earth in about, I think, six or seven nations right now. And that's in addition to about 700 bases and maybe another 200 in Iraq and Afghanistan, and an unknown number, but probably no more than 30 secret bases in the world. But see, that's the point. The point is that type of extension of military power and devoting $1 trillion a year to a defense budget, and our defense budget is roughly $1 trillion a year, because only about half of it's actually in the Defense Department. Like the Department of Energy carries nuclear weapons costs. And so we have defense spending spread out in a whole bunch of different departments. So when you hear,
there's no disagreement on that. The people in Congress, they all agree about that.
That doesn't matter.
That's not going to change.
It doesn't matter what they agree on, what they don't agree on. The point is a simple one, and it's called overextension. And it's no different than you and me and our checkbooks. We have to have more coming in than we have going out. Otherwise, we go belly up. And eventually, if you spend too much on the care and feeding of the empire, you spend more caring and feeding the empire, then the empire is hurting. You're going to go belly up. And historically, that's pretty much happened to every empire, going back to Alexander and the Romans and so forth, and the British in the 20th century. Eventually, the cost of imperial adventure outweighs any possible benefits, and you go belly up like a dead goldfish in a bowl. And the United States, we're pretty big, we're pretty resilient, but even the United States can't do this indefinitely. Now, the military themselves have a phrase for this, and the military calls it the tyranny of numbers, and that the military itself is well aware that you can't consume, you know, whatever it is, how many gallons of gasoline they're going through a month, 350,000 gallons. You can't do that indefinitely. You can't indefinitely eat up all these resources. Dwight Eisenhower and C. Wright Mills called it the military-industrial crisis or complex. Khrushchev in Russia, he called it the steel eaters. And it all comes back to the same thing. Eventually, we'll get overextended and it'll blow up. Now, what has this got to do with race?
What do I think it has to do with the race?
Hold on a second. Dr. Riley, were you finishing your statement? Or?
That was just a sort of a rhetorical question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to check, because I think two other people are still on the line here. Did anybody else have a question or comment?
I was just going to say that, Obama serves as a similar to neocolonialism right now. So, you know, the whole aspect of the relationship of the conditions of black people here who are the most oppressed in this country, his selection, as I call it, as opposed to an election, is where we are. And so just many of the things that Mr. Riley has said, I kind of disagree with, but that's my point.
Oh, I had a question for Mr. O'Reilly.
Sure.
Dr. O'Reilly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering, will we ever see a time where non-white people across the globe would have some form of self-determination, being able to control their own resources, et cetera, and will this take place after the hegemony ends? Do you see that actually taking place? Because if we're honest with ourselves, nations do not have control over their own resources.
Yeah, I'm in history, so we go back. Woodrow Wilson, World War I, after World War I, the big thing was a concept called self-determination. You know, break up the old Austro-Hungarian Empire and have self-determination for the people of the Balkan area of Europe, and also the people who lived in the colonies of European nations across the globe, from the South Pacific to Africa and China and, you know, Asia and the Philippines and so forth. Yeah, these are not new concerns, the idea of sovereignty and self-determination. And the issue is, again, one of hegemony, domination by others.
White people?
Often it's white people, but it's not necessarily white people. I mean, if you had to bet today on who would exercise the most hegemony or domination in the next century, China might be a good bet. I wouldn't bet on China. I think they're going to have all sorts of economic problems because they're growing too fast and they're going to get overwhelmed. But I might be wrong, and a lot of people believe I am wrong, and that China is liable to be the dominant hegemony in the 21st, or at least in the second half of the 21st century, and they ain't white. Who knows?
Well,
Nobody
just be clear that I'm not. Go ahead. I'm not in favor of any system of mistreatment, be it a Chinese system of mistreatment.
Well, me
or
neither.
I'm just saying that there has to come a point where justice is in place, where people are able to you know, like, you know, it said, determine their own destiny. And that's not taking place right now.
Yeah, it's...
The other gentleman talked about the toxic waste being dumped in Somali waters. You know, you have the crippling sanctions in Zimbabwe. You have the situations all over that are just, the truth never comes out. The average white person doesn't understand what's going on in Somalia or Zimbabwe. All they know is there are a bunch of black people there that have no ambition or all have AIDS. So controlling the average, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's if you break that down to the lowest common denominator, that's a big problem in our country today. And it's a global problem, too, in that we have a mass consumer culture. And so we like those, you know, itty-bitty, easily understood, you know, soundbite stories. And Somali, what's the soundbite story this week, you know? Black pirates, right, and U.S. Navy SEAL heroes who kill them. Is that overly simplistic and, in fact, a ridiculous caricature of what's going on in that part of the world? Absolutely. So why do we push that in our media? Well, of course it is, and that's the problem. We have, you know, this mass, you know, consumer culture that tends to steamroll other people, and it also tends to deaden ourselves because we don't get a presentation of what's happening, heck, on our own block often, let alone halfway around the world. Instead, we get these, you know, these cartoon histories like the one we're getting this week about this pirate episode in Somalia.
I wanted to check with anybody. Take last question here. Nat Turner, did you have a last question or comment?
No, I'm good, brother.
Oh, okay. Mr.
Turner, is that your real name? Or is that a...
Right now it is.
Right now, yeah.
You
know who Nat Turner is, right?
It's actually Nat Turner 187.
Yeah. Oh, so that's your
You familiar with the 187 part of it, too?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Then you know who Gabriel Prosser is then, too, right?
Sure do.
Yeah.
520, did you have... Oh, is Abina still here? I just wanted to check. Abina, are you here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Did you have a question, last question or comment for Dr. Riley?
Well, if it did any last comment, I'm very clear that racism is alive and well, and it is not a secret in the lives of African descendants. So while you may assert that there's been progress, that seemingly it is certainly the case, because it certainly seems that there's been progress for white people of whatever ethnicity or background you all come from here in America. There's been progress for you all, yet for folks of African descent and the voices in the margin of whom I represent, racism is alive and well, and it's not a secret. Jim Crow laws are still in place, they're still intact. You just do not see the wounds because they're emotional. And so therefore, it's easy for folks to defend, maintain their defenses and their assertions that it just really doesn't exist.
Well, my assertion is that the only two assertions I made is that slavery no longer exists and Jim Crow no longer exists.
That's your assertion.
The third assertion is that racism no longer exists. I did not make that one.
Okay, well, you know, slavery, racism, Jim Crow, for a black person, it's all one and the same. And that is the piece that I have a sense that may be difficult for you as a white person to fully appreciate for folks of African descent here in America, but not just here in America, wherever across the globe we find ourselves. They are all part and parcel of the same system of white supreme lunacy.
Yeah, well, slaves didn't have no internet. I know that for a fact.
Oh, so because we got internet, we free. That's what you're saying?
No, what that means is it's different. That's what it means.
You know,
different. Very good. No, wait a minute, Nat. That's very good. It's just different, and that is the point.
it's different. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means it's different.
That's all I've been saying all night.
And that's all I'm saying as well.
And you know what? Different can be, it can be better or worse, but it can't be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So you can. I don't have a problem with anybody arguing it's worse. My only point is it's different.
Okay.
520, did you have a final comment or a question for Dr. Riley?
No, I wanted to thank both Dr. Riley and yourself for having this show. It's really great. I really try to catch whenever you're having a show, actually through the code.net and counterracism.com. There's also another website, Black Agenda Report. I would also like to throw a shout out to Global Research, the Center for Research on Globalization, also a great website. And thanks a lot.
Can you tell us the second website? Because I didn't catch that one.
It's called the Center on Research for Globalization. It's globalresearch.ca.
Okay. Well, there was another website before that, I believe. Black Agenda
BlackAgendaReport.com.
Yes. Can you say that again, please?
BlackAgendaReport.com.
BlackAgendaReport.com. Okay. Do you have a show as well that you want to plug? I'm sorry.
Not at this time.
Okay. Abina, please plug your show.
Oh, no, I want to plug it. It's not a show. You know me. It is not a show. It's a meet and yo. But based on what Mr. O'Reilly has revealed in terms of the FBI, you know, it's very clear to me that, you know, having a program to support Black people with healing and recovering from trauma, just by virtue of the fact that it's a program that's geared specifically towards the African American population, that can be subject to scrutiny, and I could be subject to you know, some of those COINTELPRO practices that don't exist anymore.
Could happen. Could happen. Mr. Nat Turner, 187, could you plug your show, please, sir?
With a Day of Outrage Radio. That's it. Like Sister Avenue said, it's not a show per se. We're not trying to entertain nobody, but, you know, we're just trying to bring information to the people.
I feel that. Do you have a set time, or should we just check Blog Talk Radio?
Usually we're on Tuesdays and Sundays, Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and usually on a regular schedule.
Okay.
And thanks for giving a shout out. I passed the word out to folks, and I think, you know, some folks came by to check you out. So
I appreciate it. I will definitely be in the house to check out some of your future broadcasts as well, because I know you have talked about similar subject matter on your show. So I appreciate the support, and will reciprocate for sure. Dr. Riley, before I let you go, I wanted to request if you could share with us some books that could give us some more information about COINTELPRO so that we could be more informed about this. That would be super helpful if you...
What I would tell your listeners to do instead is in community libraries,
mm-hmm.
you can get a copy of the FBI file. I mean, this, you know, no matter what, this is still America. And anybody, if you can, you know, get the money together for a community library or public library in your neighborhood, you can get the file from the
FBI. What's the name of the file?
Counterintelligence file. And you can get the, just buy the reel that refers to a microfilm reel that refers to the black, what the FBI called the black hate group COINTELPRO.
Hmm.
And that's the one that deals on the color line. And again, it's mostly Black Panthers. But I mean, you can get books. You can buy my book. And please, everybody go out and buy 10,000 copies of my book. I would love that.
Right.
But you can get the whole file. I mean, it's not that hard to do. You can buy it from a microfilm company. You can Xerox it at the FBI building. I mean, no matter what, this is still America. And these type of documents you can get.
You can Xerox it at the FBI building?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Go
in there, make an appointment, tell them you want them, and they'll do it for you, too. Now they'll charge you like 10 cents a page. but you know, they'll do it.
Wow. Okay. Is there? Do you have one book in particular that you think is a good one on the subject matter?
On the FBI? Oh, there's just so many of them. But the other than my own books, of course, I always want to plug my own books. There's Richard Powers' biography of J. Edgar Hoover. My professor at Marquette, Ethan Theo Harris, he has a biography of J. Edgar Hoover called The Boss. It's an older book from the 70s, which is an amazing book. And it's right, it deals with what happened to the FBI when Hoover died. It's called Just the FBI by Sanford Unger. I mean, there are just so many, you know, really, really good books. And there's a reference earlier this evening that a book I'd like to plug. Someone mentioned The Invisible Man. You know, Ralph Ellison. That book really still holds up so well. You know, it's fiction, it's a novel, but it's one of my favorites. One of the first books I read when I was around 12, I read three books when I was like 12 or 13 that really got me interested in doing what I'm doing now. And one was Claude Brown's book, Manchild.
Mm.
And Manchild in the Promised Land, Ralph Ellison, The Invisible Man. And the third book, believe it or not, was Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Hmm.
And those are the first three real books I ever read in my life when I was about 12 or 13. You know, that weren't like Hardy Boy books and stuff like that. And that really got me, you know, interested in, you know, doing what I do for a living. So
wow.
So I always plug those books.
Okay. I am very appreciative for you hanging out with us this evening. I didn't think you'd have enough time to hang in there.
Well, I really didn't, but I did hang in.
I am very appreciative. I'm sure our listeners are as well. And we made the interview work even despite my incompetence with the time zones. Again, my apologies, Dr. Riley, for that.
That's all right. I had fun. And I like you have spirited audience. I like that. That's fun. It's more fun to argue with people when you can see them face to face, and you can't do that on the internet and the radio.
For sure, sure. Again, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, author of Racial Matters and Nixon's Piano. I definitely want to check. I have not read that yet, but I do want to check that out. Thank you again for stopping by on the Cows. Greatly appreciate it. We'll be looking to read your upcoming work as well.
Okay, thank you, and I had a blast.
Thank you. I had a blast as well. Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.